Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Weekly Manga Recap. It is May 11th, 2016. We're back after the break for Golden Week when we had no manga to talk about. We got plenty of manga to talk about this week. Holy shit, it's probably going to take a while.
I hope everybody caught last week's episode that we did in replacement of a regular episode where we talked about all the new things going on in the world of Cinnamon. Weekly Recap. It was pretty fascinating. We actually got to number 3 on the hobby podcast list with that one episode, and then we dropped off the face of it this week. So if you try looking now, it's only because we created something so much better that we then had the rest fall in comparison. It's not that we just disappeared immediately.
We're currently looking for a way that we can kind of find a marriage between the two topics so that we can get that sweet hobby podcast popularity on iTunes while staying true to our roots. We're thinking of calling it the Cinemanga Recap. It's a work in progress. And also, there are very few manga out there that have a specific focus on Cinnamon. Just Cinnamon.
We thought Food Wars would eventually get there. But it seems to mostly just to be about women's clothes exploding. Mm-hmm. So,
especially this week.
Yeah. I don't think we could do a podcast on that. Well, I think we could. We just wouldn't be allowed on iTunes or Decent Society.
It would end up being like titled like Cinnamon with an S or something like that.
Yeah. By the way, Nick, I feel we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the huge news that came out very recently.
Which news was that?
The news that a new generation of Pokemon is coming out. They showed us Pokemon Sun and Moon and gave us our first glimpse of the legendaries, and then most particularly, the new starters.
Right. Yeah.
So there's 3 of them.
Classic people are already formula. Like forming teams. This happens seemingly with every division.
Mm-hmm. Every new generation, there's a battle over which is the best starter.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad that I think there's not really going to be one this year, though, because it's very obvious that Rowlet is best. It's not even. The next words out of your mouth aren't, I agree.
I'm not going to fight you on this, Chris. I'm not going to fight you.
Okay, because I will fight you.
Can we at least all agree that the water one is the worst?
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah, I'll give that. All right, cool.
That stupid little dog seal piece of shit.
Fuck that thing. Nick, you navigated the situation expertly. I feel like if they had you in Civil War, there wouldn't even been a fight.
Just like... Steve and Tony are about to come to blows, and suddenly someone comes in. Hey, guys, remember what a piece of shit Loki was? Yeah!
You come in.
Just not so bad.
Hey, guys, I think we can work our way out. And the movie ends with, like, Cap and Iron Man, like, arm in arm, and Bucky over there with, like, a plum, like, killed your parents, Tony! And he's like, come on. What are you gonna do?
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah, my favorite is Litten. It's a fire pet. I'm just explaining why I like Litten the best. I've got no problem with Rowlet. I think Rowlet's cute. But I just like Litten because it's this very unimpressed-looking cat, which means that it is probably the most realistic cat Pokemon that they've actually come out with so far. And judging by the stripes, it looks like it's going to be a fire-breathing tiger when it's fully evolved. And that sounds awesome to me.
That's what I keep hearing people say when they like it, so I suppose I can see it. There's just something about Rowlet's face. It just doesn't give a fuck. Like, that's the face that if I wake up and it's staring at me from the ceiling, I'm like, I'm okay with this death. Because I know that you're going to make this happen.
Because you care nothing for me.
Yeah, it's like staring into the face of death, but at the same time, the most adorable face on the planet.
It's good.
Yeah. And I will literally fight anybody who says they don't like Rowlet. Anybody.
And it's weird because it's they're all very pet-like. Because, you know, one's a bird, one's a cat, one's a dog. You know?
Or some aquatic abomination thingy.
Well, it's because it's like a dog seal.
Yeah. You know?
It's fine. I have something else I want to talk about before we get into this. So, I did this long stream of tweets at like from like 4:30 to 7 in the morning a couple weeks ago when I decided to sit down out of pure curiosity and watch the Disney Channel original movie Descendants. which is about the children of major Disney villains going to high school to bond with the children of, like, Disney princesses and heroes and such. And how it's like, oh, they're the bad kids, but they could be good.
Wait, this is an official...
It's official account.
But it's an officially made... It's not like a fan fiction that someone just hijacked the network and put it on.
It was actually officially promoted by Disney Channel. It's got, you know, young Disney actor, singer types in it playing the parts. Yeah, this was an official thing. Basically, it was like... And it's a musical, too. It's pretty much a bond... A way to make High School Musical style fan fiction about the entire Disney canon. Like, Mulan's kid shows up in a minor role. The main good character is Belle and the Beast's son, who is, like, the prince of, like, the United Kingdom. Also, the Beast is called King Beast. Like, he was the Beast because he was cursed, but then he went back to being, you know, the prince, the unnamed prince. Mm-hmm. But they still call him Beast. It's weird. It's the worst goddamn...
Yeah, I was like, how does this work if there's, like, 12 kings?
That's a good question.
It's like, if all the Disney princesses' kids are going to school, what's the, like, line of royalty going to this one kingdom?
It is a terrible goddamn movie. Like, if you look back through my Twitter feed, like, there's a string of about 20 tweets where I just list problems that I have with it. 90% of it, I don't even bother to, like, name, because it all comes down to, this is a Disney Channel movie that's directed at tweens, and therefore is not intended for me. But if you look beyond that, it's just bad in so many other ways. It's poorly written, it's inconsistent... some of the characters make no goddamn sense. The villains, who the children of the villains, their parents show up. They're the most undignified portrayals of major Disney villains you'll ever see. The Evil Queen, isn't it, from Snow White? She's just called the Evil Queen.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I didn't know she even had a name.
She does have a name. It's Grimhilda.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But there wasn't a Kingdom Hearts world based on it, so I don't know that offhand. But there was.
Everyone just calls her the Evil Queen, though. It's super awkward, because there's a bunch of Evil Queens.
Yeah, I was like, what happens if Maleficent walks by? Every time someone's like, Evil Queen, she like turns, like, oh, not me, okay. Maybe we should refer to each other by nouns.
Well, Maleficent is in it. She is the main villain.
Okay.
Her daughter is the main character of the film. And by the way, almost all of the kids... have horribly lazy names. The Evil Queen's kid is Evelina, or something like that, or Evelyn. Jafar's kid is Jay.
Oh, wait, this is all live action?
It's all live action.
Okay, I'm looking...
Cruella DeVille's kid is Carlos, because she's French and he's Spanish.
Yeah, I was like, how does that work?
And Maleficent's kid is Mal. But Maleficent is basically Rita Repulsa. Like, that's how, you know, that character who was the horribly weird, tall, green-skinned, powerful witch who had horrible grudges for not being invited to, like, birth of children and all that shit. She's just, like, talking about how she's going to take over the world after she sends kids to steal this major artifact or something like that. I don't know. I've forgotten so much of it. Because most of my problem with it is just like, wow, these characters are lame. Like, Maleficent's kid is like literally the only one that was thought out with any level of consistency. And to give you an idea of how bad the writing is, Evil Queen kid, they establish that she uses a handheld version of the magic mirror, as in mirror, mirror on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
In order to see a bunch of things. And so she uses this in science class because they go to a Disney high school. And she used this in science class to cheat. In order to, like, answer a question when she was caught off guard by it. But then they establish, like, three scenes later that she's actually a scientific genius.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm reading their character descriptions here, and it says she's supposed to be super smart.
She is super smart. She just, rattles off this random fact about how tears that are caused by emotion are different than tears that are caused by a physiological response. And it was like, huh, okay. But then they establish later that the teacher finds out about the handheld mirror and confiscates it from her and forces her to take a test without it. And she's like, oh no, what am I going to do? And the one kid in class who believes in her is like, no, you can do this. And then she gets a B+ and is like, thanks for believing in me. Now I know that I can do this. And it's like, well, you're a scientific genius. Were these scenes filmed in a different order? Because it would make perfect sense if she relied on the magic mirror, was really smart all along, discovered that because the mirror was taken away from her and she had to rely on her own abilities, and then later on, she is confident in herself and so she just starts rattling off facts because she's super smart. That would be fine. Mm-hmm. But no, it's like, she demonstrates knowledge in the middle of that while still thinking that she's a vapid idiot. I was just like, it got to a point where I was like curious for about the first 10 minutes. And then I was like, well, this is going to be terrible. I'm going to see how deep the rabbit hole goes.
This is a full-length movie?
It's 2 hours long. It's like an hour and 50 minutes without commercials.
I have reached this point. I like Disney. You know, like, I'm not even talking like, I like their side stuff like Marvel and then Star Wars. Like, I like Disney as a whole. I feel that the Disney-themed stuff is getting ridiculous. Because you have this, you have all the live-action Disney movies they're now doing again. And then there's the show, I cannot watch it, and cannot comprehend why it is still airing Once Upon a Time, which is just fuck it, everything together. If you've ever read a plot synopsis, it sounds like the most absurd shit in the world. I have one here. In Oz, Mulan and Ruby meet up with Dorothy to confront Zelina.
Stop right now. In Oz, Mulan.
Andrew, yeah, it's just like, this is fucking ridiculous. I can't do this.
No, I like a lot of older Disney Channel movies, too. Some of the stuff that they did when I was like a preteen or a teenager, I've gone back and watched some of them. Some of them are still actually pretty good. There's a movie called Luck of the Irish, which is about a kid discovering that he's half leprechaun. And that's actually a really fun movie. It's Disney Channel movie as hell, but it's still really fun. So it's like, I know that they're capable of doing good stuff, but it's just like, Jesus Christ, this movie killed me.
Yeah, they, it's not great.
Alright, I think that we've gone on long enough without talking about cinnamon, on our cinnamon podcast. Let's get into it. We read the second part of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure for our discussion this week. Battle Tendency is called, which is about the second JoJo, Joseph.
Joseph Joestar!
This part is very different from the first part.
This is a tremendous departure from the first one in almost every significant way. Because this is... thematically, it's very different.
And it looks like everything you've heard JoJo looks like.
Mm-hmm. This is really kind of the start of everything that is JoJo. You got a little glimpse of what JoJo was like when Jonathan fought that one guy. They were both, chained around the neck. Like, just sort of a weird, kind of wacky fight sort of thing. But it doesn't really set you up for the most of what JoJo as a series is. But this is basically the genesis of almost every trope that is kind of part of JoJo. This is where all, the silly posing and the, you know, the wacky fights and the absurd characters and the crazy efforts characters have to go through to actually finish off opponents. Mm-hmm. This is where you kind of get all that in a row. And I'll let you kind of take the lead on this since you're new to this. Okay. I want to hear what you thought.
All right, so we start off with Joseph Joestar, who is this punk kid, basically. Gets in a lot of trouble, but has a good heart, you know. He is, right away, comes off as very different from Jonathan Joestar,
It's absurdly different.
They both got that noble soul to them, but Jonathan was, like, proper gentleman brawler type, would always do the right thing, would always conduct himself in, or try to conduct himself in a proper manner and do the right thing. Basically, if we're going to use D&D terms, Jonathan Joestar, lawful good as hell. Joseph Joestar, chaotic good. Mm-hmm. Like, very chaotic good. His first major fight is against Straits.
Yeah.
That minor character who showed up towards the end of part one, and he's a vampire now. He found the stone mask, he wanted to, like, live forever, so he decided to give up his humanity to become eternally youthful. And so he fights with Joseph, and at one point he's losing the fight, so he takes this random woman hostage. This woman doesn't even get a name.
Yeah.
He takes her hostage and is like, if you don't back off, I'm going to kill her. And Joseph says, why would I want to rescue an ugly hag like that who's a complete stranger to me?
Yeah, I think he does a lot. Like, he's like, she's not even that attractive.
No, if you're gonna take someone hostage that I don't even know, at least make it a hot girl.
Yeah, come on.
He's completely bluffing because he's a good guy and he doesn't want to see an innocent hurt. But Jonathan would never say something like that. He would say, "Unhand that innocent woman. This is between you and I. You know, fuck. You know, if you're going to hurt someone, hurt me instead." And just like, I don't think that guy's gonna hurt her. When he demonstrates he's serious, he, like, you know, breathes inside her mouth and fucking tears a tooth out. He's like, Jesus Christ! Oh, God, let her go!
Yeah.
But he's very different, and the differences between him and Jonathan make Joseph a much more entertaining and sympathetic hero. He is so goddamn funny at so many different points in this series, because he's such a weird goofball. There's a point later on where he realizes he's outmatched against Straits, and so he's like, okay, well, my first plan didn't work, my backup plan didn't work, so it's time for plan C. Okay, let's run away.
I'm out of here. He's a hilarious character, and he has so much personality to him that even RK himself admits, like, Jonathan wasn't all that interesting, so I tried to kind of improve that with Joseph. And he's like, his biggest regret, he's like, I really wish I hadn't made them look so similar, because after doing 8 parts now, he's like, these two look so much alike, but one of them's so much more interesting than the other guy.
One of them wears a hat sometimes.
but Joseph's so much fun because he has such a stark personality difference on top of being charismatic. For against Jonathan, because it's not just that he has so much more charisma to him, it's just the fact that, as you said, you know, Jonathan was this very upstanding, formal, sophisticated in a way, man's man. Whereas Joseph, you know, he has still those good traits, but he's also a lying trickster shithead cat. Like, he does pretty douchey things through a lot of the series, and even as we find out through the rest of the JoJo parts, he's still kind of a shithead. Like, he still does some
I've watched that scene with Darby that you love so much from part 3, and he's being a shithead in that scene.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a small spoiler of part 4, but the main protagonist of part 4 is Joseph's son through an illegitimate affair. So, like, you know, years later, even though he's happily married to Susie Q, he still went off, got some strange on the side, had a kid. Like, it all, you know, pays off. But he's a guy who definitely, you know, is a good person, but he makes a lot of mistakes. And I think that kind of helps to give him a little bit more dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also just a shithead at times.
He really is. It's very fun. And he has a lot more interesting dynamics with different characters. Because, I mean, like, the only relationships that I can think of that Jonathan really had in part one were, of course, he had the, you know, heated rivalry with Dio Brando. He was desperately trying to get George, his father, to, you know, believe in him and trust in him. And then he had friendly relationships with some people, and he had a mentor relationship with Tom Petty.
Yes.
In this one, Joseph's major ally is Caesar.
Yeah.
And they fucking hate each other. They grow to respect each other, but they never get along. They're constantly bickering.
They do become, I think, friendly by the end.
Very shonen teammates.
Yeah, very much rivalry, though. But I do think they reach a middle ground by the end of it. But as I said, when it starts off, they hate each other. Like, Joseph thinks he's a snob, Caesar thinks he's just kind of an arrogant asshole. Like, the two of them are constantly fighting, but they get put into, like, the training method. This, you know, one of, I think, the better training arcs are, like, little training elements, I think, a series done. I think, like, the pillar kind of ranks up near, like, the death march of being something that I'm like, oh, by the time the character actually got out of this, I really got the idea that they had gotten better, essentially. And once they get past that, they still bicker and fight, but they have a camaraderie to them that I think works a lot.
Because they've been through this experience together.
Mm-hmm. And what's really kind of unique about Part 2 is it's, you know, this is the first time we're jumping to a new character and a new theme, new setting, new everything like that. But of all the parts throughout JoJo, Parts 1 and Part 2 are the ones that are most closely kind of entwined. Because there are a lot of characters in Part 1 that return in Part 2. A lot of elements are still in there. It continues the Zappelli, Joestar line and the tragic fate that the Zappellis are destined to always die to help the Joestar succeed. There's a lot of cool connections to that, and that, I think, helps a lot when you're getting into JoJo and making that jump into a new series a little bit easier. Because there aren't that many two unfamiliar characters you have to kind of get into. Except for Smokey, but he's pointless and super racist.
He really is just kind of like, just there to be this big-lipped kid.
It's really super racist. Who I love, this is a small spoiler to the end of it, but they do like a epilogue at the end of the series for what happened to everyone. And it's like Smokey, who some reason got one's like, Smokey went on to become the first black mayor of his hometown in Georgia. I'm like, how the fuck did this happen? This kind of came, I didn't, one, I didn't know he was from Georgia. Two, I didn't see anything in him that suggested he's a mayoral caliber candidate. Like, all he did was get harassed by cops and JoJo saved him.
Oh, God. I really did like reading through the series, because Part 1 had its cool moments, but really it did hinge on Dio Brando being over the top as hell.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, there's a lot more to enjoy from the protagonist, who is in more of it. The villains aren't as interesting as Dio.
They're not as interesting, but by the end of it, I think Cars and Wham do enough to be memorable-ish. It's impossible to compare to Dio Brando, because that's such an absurd villain. But Wham and Cars, I think, are effective in their own ways, definitely.
This is definitely a part also where you can really see, like, this was the one where I was like, Jesus Christ, these rock and roll references are getting really overt. There's just a guy named AC/DC.
AC/DC. I love how they translate it to in the Viz version, because they can't use the rights to these musicians' names. So, for most of them, they just have to kind of dance around it. So, like, for Santana, it's actually, like, well done, where it's just, like, Santaviana or something like that. Something that actually sounds like a person's name. And then Wham is Wamu. So you're like, okay, kind of just sounds like how they pronounce Wham in Japan anyway. And Cars is just Cars, but with a K. But then AC/DC, they're like, all right, we have to phonetically spell out AC/DC and make it sound like what it's supposed to be. So it's like A-S-I-E-E-D-E-S-S-I. It's so fucking weird.
Santana's the one that actually surprises me the most, because it's like, Santana's a real name.
I think they just did it to stray away from having to worry about it. They change everybody's kind of, except for, I'm trying to think if Lisa is actually a real musician's name or not.
Lisa is the name of a singer.
Okay. So they didn't change that one at all, but I guess maybe that one did fall into that category where they're like, meh, whatever.
I mean, AC/DC, you couldn't really get
away with. No. I mean, shit, I don't think AC/DC's even on Spotify yet. They'd probably go crazy if they were like, you're using our name in a manga!
They're like, what the fuck ever? You haven't been real AC/DC since Bon Scott died.
Nick coming out with the harsh truths.
Someone disagree with me. Oh, God. I don't really know how much else there is to talk about the series, other than, like, I enjoyed it and it was ridiculous. Oh, we should talk about the art, I guess. Okay, so part one had some weird bits to it. This is where you can really tell that Araki was just pulling out the male model catalogs. Just everywhere. There are so many goddamn ridiculous poses that get struck absolutely randomly throughout this part. It is fucking crazy.
It will get more and more like that as the series goes on. But there are just... I don't even think there's that many bad poses in this one. There are points in later manga, or later parts, where you'll just get characters who are just like, I'm gonna fight you. And you're like, why are you standing like this? Like, I just am. Because I have a stand. Fight me. Come at me, bro.
Just the way that people, that they twist their bodies around, and so their limbs and chest get so disproportionate. Like, there's a bit where Lisa shows up, and like, one of the first times you see her, she's got her hands on her hips.
Yeah.
Just kind of cocking her arms. Her arms are, like, as big as her torso. It's so weird to look at, and it's really distracting. And it's one of the things, like, between the ridiculous fighting and the ridiculous finishes to fights, the ridiculous techniques used in fights, this is definitely going... You can tell how JoJo's Bizarre Adventure ended up reaching, like, the point that it did. You can definitely see, like, how far along it came from part one in terms of those themes or tropes, I guess.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, when Caesar first shows up, he just flat out says, like, my special ripple technique is combines with bubbles. Mm-hmm. That's his starting
point. That's how I do it.
I use bubbles, you know, enhanced with the ripple. They still use the ripple in this part.
Yes.
And if I understand correctly, part three is where they start bringing in
Immediately from part three on, they use stands. I think Joseph is in part three, and he uses Hamen, I believe, once or maybe twice, but he gets a stand in that series as well. So it's basically stands from here on forward. Araki talks about it a little bit in the volumes as well, where he was looking for new ways to implement Hamen in the series. So, you know, Caesar has the bubbles, Joseph uses the clackers, and everything else. Lisa has her scarf. He was looking for new ways to implement it because it made for more interesting fights. And that's kind of what brought him into the idea of stands, these opponents that can put in these crazy, ridiculous fights. It's actually somewhat interesting because I think part two is actually more representative of the kind of fights that embody the series of JoJo than even what you get in part three when stands are introduced. Because a large part of the stands at the start of part three are very simplistic. Like, Jotaro's stand is really fast and really strong. You know, one controls fire, one controls sand. Like, they're not all that crazy, you know, it's later parts where they do absurd shit. But in this... Through the use of Hamen, they're doing absolutely absurd and ridiculous things all the time. Like, Caesar has this amazing moment where he basically, like, sharpens bubbles, breaks them through a wall, and then has them, like, reflecting light at a super intense angle to try to destroy one of the pillar men. You're like, this shit is ridiculous. But it's just that embodiment of the JoJo series that makes it so awesome.
Well, and the pillar men themselves are freaking weird as fuck. The Pillar Men are the villains in this series, and I'm not sure if I got the background quite right on this. Essentially, they've been sealed away.
Yes.
They're revealed to have created the stone masks.
They're essentially some sort of life form that's always existed on Earth, separate from humanity. Kind of like, I think they're supposed to be like a super-powered vampire thing, essentially. They've always just been like that. The sun was against them, but they were a peaceful race. They always lived underneath the Earth. They don't really need to procreate, so they don't really, they're just a very...
Which Joseph asks about in a very direct manner. Hey, that one's a guy! Are there girl men in pillars? Do they recreate?
So they don't really have, like, they're a peace society, but then Kars was just super intelligent and was like, I want more. So he created the stone mask to give him power and to create more vampires, and then he was like, well, shit, sunlight still hurts us. We need a stone. So let's peace out into this rock for a while and see if one pops up.
So the first one that appears, the Nazis are going full on like Indiana Jones on this. They're like, oh, an ancient power. We could use this to fight the Americans. Basically. It takes place in 1938, I think.
Yeah, it's right on the cusp of World War II really picking up.
Right. So they found this, and one of them, von Stroheim, says, I shall name this man Santana after bullshit explanation so that Carlos Santana / the band Santana can be referenced. And to determine how strong they are, they're like, oh, and we gave this prisoner the stone mask. Let's have them fight. And they fight, and Santana's main technique is to basically eat people with his body. Whenever he touches someone, he starts to just meld with them.
And he just kind of fuses into them and, like, devours them.
He just kind of absorbs them. And there's this really creepy scene because he can manipulate his body freely, where he, like, cracks his bones and tears apart his joints in order to escape through a vent. The Nazis are trying to find him. He leaps out of the vent and starts to bond with this guy. And he just kind of, like, puffs up his body because he's bonding with / eating him, while the guy's like, oh, this feels kind of funny.
This is sort of a weird experience.
Oh, this feels good, guys. Hey, check it out. And then they try and shoot him, and he absorbs the bullets and shoots them back.
There's a scene I even found more terrifying than that later on when they meet the other pillar men, where essentially it's, again, the Nazis have found them. One of them's woken up. I forget which one actually does this. I feel like it's Kars, but I'm going to probably get that wrong. But the pillar man that escapes basically goes into the first guy and then, like, moves through him into a bunch of other people and basically, like, fuses all their hands together in one long chain. And then he just devours them in, like, a complete, like, a human centipede. Like, just, oh my God, it's terrifying. Wham. And, okay.
They talk about, I was like, oh my God, the blood from the soldiers is covering the lambs, so it's going to set the other pillar men free.
But I feel like the pillar men, as we mentioned, kind of have like a little bit of an impossible challenge to live up to Dio. And the first two don't, like, I honestly forget Santana 90% of the time because he doesn't
His whole thing is that he is rapidly learning. Like, he's like a newborn baby that knows nothing at first, and then he rapidly learns as he consumes people because he gains their intelligence as he consumes them.
Yeah, but he doesn't have the same kind of distinct abilities that everyone else has. And they fight him so early on that it's difficult to remember him with everyone else. Right. AC/DC is a little bit easier to remember because, one, his name's awesome, but two, like, he has a more distinct kind of role in the series. But the other two, I feel, do actually have better personalities. And Wham in particular is a great villain. Like, he's, you know, a super powerful being. These guys are essentially the closest thing to gods out there. Not quite at that level yet. But he's this very honorable person because he's woken up from this 1,000-year sleep. And JoJo and Caesar are there, and they're fighting him, and they can't beat them. They're just not in their caliber, but they manage to land a couple blows. And JoJo is about to die, and he's like, hey, you know, man, if only I had a month, maybe I could fight you enough to beat you. And Wham's like, I would like to see that. So I'm going to place this poison ring inside of you, and we're going to see what happens if you manage to make it out of this. So you get this cool character who's this honorable foe. He's insanely powerful, but he has this very strong sense of, like, a warrior's pride, to the point where there's a very sad scene. Caesar fights against him, loses, and his last act is to basically, like, pull this ring off of Wham that has an antidote that JoJo needs, and he places it in a Haman bubble. It's his last, everything that he has left is put into this Haman bubble, and then he dies. And Wham's like, you were an honorable opponent. I could just break the bubble and take the ring back, but I'm not going to shit on your last efforts, essentially. And he willingly leaves the bubble behind. And like, okay, I really get a good sense of who this guy is. And it leads into this really awesome fight that he and JoJo have that's honestly one of my favorites, not just in JoJo, but maybe of all fights of all time. It is an absurdly ridiculous fight that they have. It's a chariot death race.
Well, and also it's something that's been built up over basically the entire series because... It was one of those things that as soon as it was set up, it was like, well, of course Caesar's not going to be the one to defeat the guy because, you know, JoJo encountered him early on. He got his ass kicked and he was like, oh, you know, I could come back in 1 month and defeat you. And he's like, yeah, I want to see that. So of course Caesar's not just going to beat the guy.
Yeah. It's strange, but they build it up well, especially once the fight begins and JoJo's like, I'm doing this because you killed my friend, and he puts on Caesar's bandana and is like, let's do this, and that bandana actually becomes the catalyst of how he essentially wins the fight, and it's an awesome moment that, like, ties together everything. I've forgotten JoJo parts from here on forward don't kill the protagonist the same way part one do, but there's usually at least one very significant death, and I forgot how hard those can hit. As I got in, I was like, oh, Caesar... your family sucks. Caesar dies right after you learn that their family is cursed to die for JoJo's. Like, it's like, oh, you didn't know your dad? Oh, you got to meet him as your dad sacrificed himself to save you, not even knowing you were his son. And he got eaten by the wall and was just being used for nutrients for the Pillar Men. You're like, oh, God.
And they kind of pull a little bit of a fake out with Joseph too, make it seem like he's dead.
Yes,
as he has his final fight against Kars, who gets launched into space.
It is an absurdly awesome fight. This is a fight where Kars gets the Redstone, which essentially is able to neutralize the one weakness that they have to Haman and then the Sun. So he gets the stone, puts it on, becomes his perfect being. Joseph has already been... it's not even that long after the fight with Wham. Like, it's, like, minutes afterwards. Puts everything together to fly a plane and crash it into Kars to dump him into a volcano while being eaten by piranhas. And it still doesn't finish him off. You're like, Jesus!
And Joseph basically lucks out.
Yeah.
He, like, instinctively defends himself, and the gem catches Kars, and the reaction launches him into space, basically.
I think it was that it distracted him, and the volcano erupts, and he can't escape. Yeah, he can't escape that. He gets distracted, the rubble keeps knocking him upwards, he can't get out of it, and then he gets launched into space, where he's like, I guess I'll just curl up into a ball and stop thinking for eternity.
Well, because he's like, oh, I'll just use the Haman to launch myself back. Damn it! It's frozen in space. I can't do anything. Oh,
poop!
And there's just this narration that's like, he never made it back to Earth, so he just drifted endlessly through the void and eventually stopped thinking. Like, oh God! Yep. Even though he wanted to die, he was an immortal being, so he couldn't.
Yeah. You'll start seeing that too. JoJo villains get horrendously fucking painful or awful deaths. And you really don't get out of it easy as a JoJo villain.
So the day is saved, and everyone's like, oh, but Joseph is dead. And then Joseph just shows up at his own funeral and is like, hey, everybody, did you miss me? What's wrong? We thought you were dead! And he's like, oh, Well, Susie, did you remember to send the telegram to them? And he's like, wait a minute, you two got married? Yeah, Susie Q and I got married. Susie, didn't you send the telegram?
Whoops!
What do you mean you forgot?
I love her, like...
And that's it!
I love her being like, whoopsies! And it's him like, god damn it! She, like,
runs away. Oh, God.
Joseph is a lot of fun. He's entertained as a protagonist. I like the character development he has with Caesar. I like the relationship he has with Lisa, who's his master and, as he comes to later find out, his own mother.
Which makes certain interactions with her very creepy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Because he's like, oh, she's hot.
Well, he doesn't know she's his mom at that point.
Right.
But
that is the plot to Oedipus, so...
But it's really just, I think he's a fun character. He's one of the better JoJo's, in my opinion. Just from the fact that he's such a distinct character. I love his trickster style. Like, he's a strong warrior, but everything he's doing is a deception. He's got this fun gimmick where he's like, here's what you're gonna say next! And then he'll say what they're going to say.
I love that, yeah. The thing you're gonna say next is, what the fuck is this asshole getting up to? What the fuck is this asshole? Wait a minute!
He's just...
And then there's a great bit where AC/DC has thrown him off so much that AC/DC does it to him, and he's like, oh, he stole my thing!
My thing! But I just love that, like, he's a character who seems like a coward and a shithead at times. There's more than one occasion that he runs away from fights, but usually the running away plays into part of his plan, and he's just fun to see him work things out. Like, this is where the series starts moving into more, like, absurd conclusions to fights. There's usually enough logic in it that you never get angry. Like, at one point during his fight with Straits, he just pulls out a Tommy gun he found somewhere along the way. But it's...
You're threatening my mom? Fuck you!
But it's so much fun and so silly, and then when the scenes get intense, they're great. I think I was getting a little bored in the mid part of this series reading through it again, because it does have sort of a weird flow. They meet the first Pillar Man, then they stop, meet Caesar, then they fight the other three, lose, go for training, and then it's the... like, immediately into the fight with the last, like, three in a row. And it's sort of a weird flow, but I think once you get to that point where Caesar's about to fight Wham, I think from thence forward, it's just stellar. Like, it's a lot of fun, the character development's great, the jokes are great, the battles are intense, you know. I love that kind of epic nature of it, especially as it moves forward. And it's one of the... I don't want to say one of my... favorite JoJo parts, because there's a lot to compare it to, and I've few that I hold very high, but I really enjoy part two, and I feel like it's a great I feel like if you can enjoy part two, you can enjoy JoJo as a whole.
It's like a more proper introduction into JoJo, I would say.
Yeah.
It reading this made me really feel like, oh, you know, I'm looking forward to more. Because I knew the part one was different, and also part one just wasn't quite as good. Like, I like Theo. I like certain parts of it, but it's like, well, Jonathan's just kind of like a good guy.
Yeah.
So, but I really did enjoy this, and looking forward to when we continue with part three.
Awesome. There we go.
All right, with that done, let's move on to the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. And we're going to start, as we usually do, with some Black Clover, which is on page 60. What the hell is this called?
Okay. The High Priest's Game!
The High Priest's Game. Yeah. So, last time, the Black Bulls went to Atlantis, basically. And the people there were creepy because they were like, oh, try not to die when you meet the High Priest, yeah. And they're at the High Priest. And we start things off with the color page this week. Probably my favorite color page in Black Clover so far.
Well, it's not cheesecakey, so that's already a point in its favor.
Right, well, it's Luck and Magna. They're each, you know, just holding, you know, their own elemental magic as they, you know, kind of dash towards the action. But I really like the pose, I like the expressions, and I like the color balance. Mm-hmm. It's really cool.
It does. The blue and orange... That, especially that kind of blue, are really interesting to visually, so.
Mm-hmm. So, the High Priest is Roshi. basically, for a bit, because he's like, all right, you have to play a game with me if you want that magic stone. It's a boob-squeezing game. And he, like, immediately just goes towards Noelle and, what, Melissa, I think is her name. And so Noelle punches him.
I was like, I'm about to correct you. I was like, Nick, no, her name's Kana. And I was like, oh, wait, no, Kana's just a character she's like. I really think they're the same person now.
Oh, God. This opening conversation that they have, it feels like Asta shouldn't be in the role that he's in.
He is, strangely, like, the one dude who's like, everyone in this guild's so crazy! I'm like, aren't, I feel like you were always the dude where it's like...
You're always enthusiastic and happy about so much stuff, you know? But instead he's like, yeah, there is this thing, there's a style of comedy, you know, a two-man act in Japan called Tsukomi Jackass, where... one guy says something stupid and the other berates him for it, basically, by being, you know, so it would be like, you know, but what do you want to go get for dinner? I want to get some cheesecake. That's not a proper meal! You know.
Cheesecake? Like, yeah.
And Asta seems like he should be the guy making stupid comments instead of the guy saying, but that was a stupid thing to say! It doesn't quite, I don't know, I didn't, it was weird because it's like, okay, I know that we're showcasing all the quirks of these different people. You know, Noel isn't patient with people. Gaush is really grim and and Luck is bloodthirsty. Finral's girl crazy. Melissa wants to drink. Charmy wants to eat. But Asta's not like the default weird quirks guy. He's excited about everything. And... So he's going around, he's like, oh, you guys are being too enthusiastic. Noelle, you shouldn't be punching the high priest. You guys need to be more enthusiastic. We're here for a mission. And eventually Yami just, like, kicks him in the back of the head. He's just like, oh, calm the fuck down. You know, we'll do this thing so that we can get the stone. And I get that from him, but I really don't, I just, like, what we know about Asta thus far is, like, it doesn't fit for me.
It's what's interesting to me is I'm like, huh, it's odd. I guess there isn't really one dedicated straight man in the Black Bulls.
Well, and that makes sense because they're all weirdos. They're all rejects.
They're all supposed to be kind of weird. So I guess in that sense, it would make sense for him to be kind of the, not straight man, but the one guy who's kind of reacted to everyone else being silly around him. I didn't have issues with that. I feel like there was a point where somebody wanted to... maybe it was last week when, like, three characters attacked, like, immediately, and he was like...
It was Gaush and Luck and Magna.
Yeah, I think that was it.
And they're the ones who are really enthusiastic because, you know, Magna's like, why don't we beat this guy up and take the stone? You know? And Gaush is like, what? You know, beat him up. We should kill him.
That's it. That's what's happening. It's because the three of them are talking about fighting the guy and taking his shit because it'd be a fun fight. And Asta's like, Magic Knights can't do stuff like that. I was like, it does seem like that'd be an Asta's character. Asta,
all you do
to.
Is beat people up with your sword.
But I'm okay with it because his face in that panel is so like, it's not even the fact that he's like at this screaming face. It's that his eye is somehow looking behind. Yeah, it's like looking backwards.
And does the same thing in the next panel, too.
It's just weird. Like, oh my god, if I was staring at him, I'd be like, what's happening to you?
Chris, what's going on? I was actually thinking to myself, like, as I was first reading through, it was like, Asta saying stuff that it seems like Finral should be saying. And I know it's because they wanted to cast Finral on the opposite end of the spectrum, being very lazy about stuff. Mm-hmm. But I just think that it would have worked better if he... because Finral, if there is a straight man in the group, it's probably him.
Yeah, he probably would be the closest.
I mean, he's a coward, I know, but... well, you know, Usopp plays straight man a lot of the time when... you know, Luffy is doing weird stuff, so...
Yeah, I mean, you can very easily bounce between them. Like, all of the Straw Hats, except for maybe Luffy most of the time, but...
basically.
Almost everyone else in the Straw Hats can act as the silly or the straight man at points. I think we're probably taking too long on this, though.
We probably are. I don't know. Anyway, so the priest declares that they're going to have a battle royal. And if the Black Bulls win, then he'll give them the Magic Stone. He summons all these other mages, who are these weird fishmen of different types. Some of them actually look, I think, pretty cool. I like the short one at the front of the group.
How did I not realize they were all fishmen? I, for some reason, thought they all had wacky masks. I don't know why. I guess I just didn't look at the hammerhead dude close enough. I was like, what strange, weird masks they're wearing.
Oh, God. And so he immediately, like, just transports everyone off. Like, this blast of water shoots everyone to different parts of this underwater cavern. And there's the voice that reaches to all of them, where he says, like, I've scattered you all to different areas inside the temple by playing Zelda's Lullaby at different locations to change the water level. But basically, they're all separated to different parts. They're going 9-on-9 against the temple mages. If they can knock them out or make them surrender, then they win. And victory goes to the first team that wipes the other out or that has the most members left at the end of the 1 hour time limit. And if there is one thing that I do like about this is that in that opening two-page thread that shows where a bunch of them have landed, they're in very different sort of environments. Luck is at this area that's got waterfalls. Ast is in this under water cavern. Melissa is at like this calm river bank and stuff.
Yeah,
playing a lot with the different environments for water.
Yeah, because they mention the Roshi dude mentions later on that you can technically meet up with your partners. And I was like, oh, that's interesting because I thought they had all just been separated into completely different locations. Kind of interesting to think that all of these places connect in some way, but it is kind of visually cool to see all these different areas. And it is one of my favorite, like, shonen tropes of having, like, everyone split up into individual battle kind of thing. I always think that's fun and cool.
But he also declares, like, you know, you can do this any way you want. You can fight one-on-one, you can group up, or you can even just try and hide to preserve yourself so you're not eliminated. But he also says that there are nuisance spells in the location, too. So Yami is the only one of them who hasn't been taken away, and the guy's like, well, you know, I you're just a bit too strong, so the game wouldn't be fun if you were to participate. And Yami's like, yeah, okay. And they watch basically like a bunch of TV monitors. They're like conjured through water magic so that they can watch the battle. And immediately, four of the temple mages get attacked and presumably get their asses kicked. We don't really get to see any confirmation that they've actually won their fights, but the high priest says, you know, like, hey, what are you guys, what are your mages' rankings? And Yami says, well, they're all junior mages. Well, according to your knight system, my temple mages would be more powerful than intermediate mages, so they can't help to match up against them. And Yami's like, well, that's unless they're all idiots who are stronger than their titles. And immediately, Magna and Luck and Asta and Gaush have attacked their opponents, and the high priest is caught off guard by how strong they are. And that's where the chapter ends. I do hope that we get more than just Asta hits people with his cleaver in this whole thing. This seems like if you're going to get us to know more of the members of the Black Bulls, this is a good opportunity to do it. Not all of them have to have their moment where they defeat a guy. But, you know, I want to see some more focus on, like, oh, okay, what's Noelle going to do? What's Melissa going to do?
Yeah.
What is Clone Guy, whose name escapes me,
going to do? But
right.
even if they're like, yeah, these four just win their fights because they're, like, the strong ones, I'd still be interested just to see what the other characters do, because it's nice to see what their capabilities in battle. Like, it's a chance to get some real character development out of some of them. So, I'm definitely interested to see what they do with that. And it'd be cooler if they leave these guys around to kind of show off more of their fighting styles or to give that. But I can also imagine, like, look, let's get these ones out of the way. Because if they did go through all of them, it'd be like 9 fights. Like, we don't have time for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just zoom through this a little bit.
Even if it's like, you know, because Noelle notes when she first gets teleported, oh shit, I don't know any offensive spells. Even if it's like, okay, she buys herself time and defends herself and uses her magic that way until someone comes along to help her. I want to see some focus on that, as opposed to, and she was knocked out, but asked to find her opponent later and beat him.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's it for Black Widow.
It's a fine chapter.
It's all right. It's all right. Let's move on to Bleach 672, Son of Darkness. Well, we went long enough before switching scenes in Bleach, didn't we?
Yeah, I almost forgot that was the status quo for so long.
Last time, Byakuya used his super ultimate Senban Sakura technique to blow the fuck up out of Gerard's head. His headless frozen corpse disintegrates in the beginning of this chapter as Hitsugaya, Super Bishi Hitsugaya collapses, and Byakuya's like, it looks like you're at your limit, that Bankai takes a heavy toll on your body. But just as they're about ready to, like, okay, let's go, you know, rest for a bit, Gerard's body starts reforming from Reishi and shit. And they're like, how is he still alive? Because that's his thing! He's gone over this with you! And Gerard's body starts to reform, although it's this seemingly made of pure energy body that's got this full-on helm as well. And then we cut away!
Yeah, like, alright, we've seen that Gerard is not, in fact, dead. Let's leave, and let's go to Uryu versus Hoshwalt.
Well, no, we don't get that first.
Oh, sorry, yes, that's right.
We get Ichigo confront Ichigo Habak. Ichigo draws Zangetsu, attacks Yu Habak, cuts him, and Yu Habak wakes up. And he goes, oh, what a dream. No better dream than a nightmare. It's like, okay, so you dreamed about Ichigo attacking you. I mean,
super sweet.
They also, because he, in the dream, he doesn't have his multiple eyes, and Ichigo has the old form of Zangetsu, unlike the one where he has the dual swords, is the one that's on his back. Okay, so he dreamed about Ichigo attacking him. That was, I don't really get it. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to rely on
maybe it'll be explained later, but it is Bleach, so I'm not going to count on it.
I was hoping for you to add the context to this.
I don't know. He's the Almighty. He sees all. So, Hoshwalt observes that it's morning, which means that he no longer has all of Yuhabak's powers, and he didn't finish off Ishida, which kind of blew it there, buddy. He had almighty power and couldn't finish off Ishida, and now you got to fight him without all power? Okay.
But apparently, his original power is more suited for battle and fighting someone like that. But I'm like, wasn't the power with the Almighty, like, essentially omnipotence? Like, what power do you have that's better for suited for battle than, like, I know everything?
So then we cut away after Hoshwell is like, my powers are more suited for this battle, and he starts to attack Ishida, and we cut away.
This was the most annoying thing, though, to me. Like, that we cut to this battle just long enough to be like, holy shit, what's happened here? Like, Ishida's arms are missing? Like, one of them looks just be a stump. The other one looks like it's nothing left. And then
I think it's just the way that they're drawn. Because he's leaning against the wall with his right arm.
But where's the actual arm?
It's behind him. He's like this. It's a very bad...
Oh, wow. I really thought that was essentially like to here to here and just cut off.
Yeah, with all the full page spreads to establish Gerard's body is still big, you'd think that one could have been used to express Ishida is really fucked up.
Okay, yeah. Now I see it. I really legitimately thought he lost his hands and one arm.
So, Ichigo Norihime have arrived at Jubak's palace, and Ichigo says, all right, Inoue, this might be kind of unfair to go two-on-one, but I need you to defend me, so I'm going to count on you, Inoue. And Rihime is like, all right! And she's flashes back to previous scenes in the series, and he's like, ah, oh, finally, I can finally fight to protect Ichigo. You can already do that!
I know I've really shit the bed in every other arc, but this time, I'm not going to be made useless.
And this, I'm just thinking to myself, it's like, this hasn't been a thing. All arc. Like, the last time Orihime got, like, any real level of focus would have been back during the Hueco Mundo arc. Like, because the last important thing that she really did would have been when she cried when Okiyora nearly killed him. Because she wasn't involved at all in the fight with Aizen. She was in the Fullbringer arc, but she got knocked out before she could really do anything because she had been brainwashed by Tsukishima. And during this arc, she's done as much as Chad. So, I mean, like, there's been, like, no focus on this whole, like, feeling of inferiority or wanting to defend Ichigo or anything like that. It's just like, hey, remember this thing that we haven't really addressed in, like, 300 chapters?
Remember the fact that her powers are supposed to be some of the strongest in, like, reality?
So, then they just walk into the palace, and they approach Ichigo's throne, and he just says, ah, I've been waiting, my son of darkness. And that's it. It's a weird, directionless chapter.
Yeah. It's not really all much.
There's not really much to note about any of the three things going on.
No, well, I mean, the Gerard thing, it's like, alright, he's not dead, but we don't really know what's happening next. Like, we don't even really get that much of a glimpse of what his form is. Like, we don't even understand how he survived. Presumably just the same miracle, never gives up or whatever. Like, he just keeps getting better. But, like, there's still no explanation to that. The Uryu thing was just weird. Especially that he didn't lose his limbs, and it's just like, well, why did we cut to this at all? Like, couldn't you have just... I guess it's just to be like, oh, okay,
he's kind of beat up, guys. He's looking tired.
Like, oh, his powers are now changed. But don't worry, his regular powers were even better. And then it's like, oh, and here we go. Orihime is going to do something. Wink, wink. Like, I'm not buying into it. I can't, Kubo. I can't.
Oh, God. Let's move on to Fairy Tail, then.
Do you want to mention Boruto at all?
Oh, I guess technically I was gonna bring that up at Naruto's place, but no, okay. Let's do it now.
All right.
So the Boruto spin-off manga, which is going to be a monthly series, premiered this week or debuted this week, whatever. And we actually begin with like a cut to the future where Boruto is fighting some guy.
Yeah. Kawaki, I think is his name, because he shouts out Kawaki
Summit. And then, basically, really, before we get anything going on, we see that Konoha is like in ruins, and that Boruto seemingly is a missing nin because his headband is scratched out.
Yeah.
And Kawaki is like, "Oh, the age of the shinobi shall end," but Boruto's like, "Well, I'm still a ninja," and they start to fight. And we cut back to the past, and Bullet's like, I'm a ninja, but back then, I could care less about ninja. It's couldn't care less! Couldn't care less!
Do you think that was a mistake in the writing, the translating, or is it just intentional, like, Boruto's a big fucking idiot kid who doesn't even care about euphemisms. He doesn't care at all!
He doesn't understand.
His dad doesn't show up enough, Nick. Why should he bother learning proper phrases? Life's hard.
Yeah. So Bolt's like, this isn't a tale about a boy who aims to become Hokage. That was my dad's story. This is my story. Okay, Titus, shut the fuck up.
I can't... It's not even... he needs to just have, like, this is a tale about a boy who needs to become Okage. That was my dad's story. Like, just the whiniest, douchiest, most entitled fuck on the planet.
Like, we were kind of, because we were basically calling it like, oh, he's just going to be like this in the main series as soon as that spinoff, not spinoff, but the miniseries about Sarada came out. No clue he was going to be this bad.
It is...
This is your main character, this whiny asshole.
It's obscene, he's so whiny, he's such a shit!
Like, because at the opening of this chapter, he goes into, like, his dad's, like, home office, and Naruto is surrounded by books and scrolls, and he's looking between them, he's hard at work, and there's no dialogue, but Bulk clearly, like, you know, greets him, and Naruto, you know, looks and he's like, oh, hey, Bolt. And Bolt's like, yeah, my dad. And he, like, goes back to work. And Bolt's like,
my dad acknowledged me, but he didn't play with me enough. Oh, my God.
He flat out says on the next page, my story begins when I was a brat who sulked about his dad not paying enough attention to him.
I guess you're supposed to get the idea that he realizes he's being a real shit by the time we get to that.
I get the impression that he seriously fucks up and he realizes what a big mistake he made, because that's obviously implied by the missing Nin headband.
Yeah.
Like, seemingly he might betray fucking Konoha over this.
But I'm trying to comprehend the situation that could come about where he fucks over the entire country and, like, does it in a way that you don't just wish he'd get fucking just beaten right there. Like, if you still want to root for him as the hero afterwards. Because he's such a shit in this chapter. It is so hard to stress how annoying he is in this. Because he's still Naruto's kid. Like, he still has, like, those annoying habits. But he's just so punchable because he has a fucking family who loves him and people are cool with him. And his dad does spend time with him, just not all the time he should with them. And you're like, oh my God.
Well, and, you know, think about it. It's like, the last series had Sasuke betray Konoha. Mm-hmm. It was because his entire clan had been massacred and he wanted revenge on his brother. It was, like, the only thing that he had thought about since he was, like, 8. You know, this person that he looked up to seemingly betrayed everything that he thought he stood for, and he wanted to kill him in order to gain revenge, and he was obsessed with it, and so he betrayed everyone that he cared about and left in order to become stronger, in order to find his brother and kill him. That was how he started off. It eventually took a direction that I think was stupid when he found out his brother was actually a good guy, and he was like, my brother was actually trying to save the village, which is why I'll destroy the village! Bolt's whole thing is, like, because they established, like, oh, there's this new technology where we can create scrolls by having a ninja, like, put their technique in a scroll, and this gets put in, like, basically, like, a tablet form. You put in this wristband thing, and now everyone can use every ninja technique, even bloodline limit ones. So, this technology, it's basically like, yeah, the age of shinobi could be coming to an end, and Naruto disapproves of this and stuff. And there's this creepy-looking scientist guy who's, like, trying to exploit the Hokage's son in order to basically prove this technology works. And there's other stuff at work, because Sasuke is checking in, and Naruto is like, oh, you're so cool, Mr. Sasuke, yeah! You fought my dad, right? He's like, yeah, I did. Well, will you be my teacher? He's like, God, you're such a little shit.
It perfectly encapsulates how much I despise Boruto that he meets Sasuke for, like, 2 seconds, and his first thought is, he's so cool! I'm like, of course you fucking think he's cool.
I have to say, Sasuke's a lot better in this short appearance than probably anything he ever did in the main storyline, because he's finally gotten over his bullshit teenage angst.
Yeah, like, now he's just an adult.
Yeah. You know, he's talking with Naruto, and he's talking about the realities and the fact that the world needs ninja and stuff. And he's talking to Naruto about his kid, and it's like, oh, they're old friends now. You know, he can't be around very much, but we learned through the Sarada series that that's kind of a necessity, because the world would be in danger otherwise.
They don't see Sarada bitching about it all the goddamn time!
Because Sarada learned her lesson after having a dad that actually wasn't around her entire life. She learned the necessity of what Sasuke was trying to do, and she became more mature. And when she shows up in this series, she's way better. Because, you know, Bolt is doing stuff, and their teacher is like, yeah, Bolt might be the next Hokage. And Sarada's like, no, I'm going to be the next Hokage. It's going to be me. She's not, like, getting in anyone's face, or she's just kind of, like, you know, being like, I'm going to be the next Hokage. And Bolt, if you're going to be my rival, I'm going to let you know the only one of us can do is going to be me. And Bolt's like, only assholes who don't care about their families want to be Hokage. It's like, shut the fuck up.
I hate you so much.
Oh, God. And there's this whole thing, because, like, oh, Naruto had to miss Himawari's birthday party. He's busy! He tried! He sent a shadow clone! Yes, it sucks he can't be there, but Jesus Christ, Bolt, stop yelling at your mom! It's not her fault! Oh, God.
So that's Boruto.
I mean, I think that the only way that it could have been worse is if it were his birthday instead of Himawari's. It's like, alright, at least it's because his sister is sad. And I was like, my dad wasn't here for my birthday, even though he was here for my birthday.
It's weird that, like, the plot of this first chapter of Boruto is, like, the plot of every 90s movie with the Kenshin as the father. He's like, you better be home for Christmas / my birthday! Like, I promise!
Naruto is spending too much time as head of his company to be with his children.
Naruto.
You know how hard it is to bring in six figures, kid.
Naruto, played by Jim Carrey.
Oh, God. Alright.
Alright, so we'll move on to Fairy Tail, chapter 484, The Savage Six. And we talked about this last time we did a chapter, Nick. Like, who could the Savage Six be? Because I don't think there are even six members of the Spriggan 12 left. Well, they answer that question in this chapter.
They answer who a few of the six are.
No, they answer the six. It's just not the six you're thinking of.
Right, right.
So we start with Erza recovering from her attack.
No, Chris. Battle. We start with Lucy as a schoolgirl in bed.
Well, yeah. I mean, I thought that kind of went without saying. We all saw
I think that Hero's been watching a bunch of, like, schoolgirl anime recently or something like that. I was like, I'm gonna draw this skirt with maybe no panties on Lucy. Also, she's reading a manga called Fairy Tail.
Oh, she is?
Yeah.
Huh. Sounds better. So Urza's waking up, and everyone's like, you're better. Don't worry, all your runes will heal. And there won't even be scars, because I guess that would make you look less unattractive. I don't know. Or more unattractive, rather. And they basically just talk about how the battle went. They succeeded in Hargeon. They've taken everybody out. The remaining troops are kind of cleaning up who's left. And the only thing really, I guess, to note is that Kaguya is, I guess, ashamed that she kissed Jaleel to save his life. So she gave him out the mouth. Yeah, which was an unintentional kiss. So she passes it on to Erza by kissing her.
Right. I kind of get it, in a way. I know it's just for a stupid, your girl's kissed moment, but also, she gave Jaleel mouth-to-mouth, which means that she kissed him before Erza did.
Yeah.
So, she's like, I'm sorry, you know, so I'm gonna pass this on to you without explaining anything.
Yeah, that's the thing, like, it's no explanation, because even afterwards, everyone's like, of course...
The only part of this that I do like is the bit at the end... You know, the bottom of the page where Erza is, like, getting smaller and smaller. She's like, what?
Well, like, I get why everyone would be shocked afterwards when she just does it and she kisses her. But she has a moment to say something, and she doesn't still explain it. She's just like, can you forgive me now? And there's still no context to why she did it. So it's just the moment where you're like, This is pretty weird. Why did you do that?
Or is this just thing? Is Kagura gonna like try and repay me with her body every time she makes a mistake around me?
We got away to Leon and Sharia, and Leon has like a little talk to talk with her, or heart to heart with her about the fact that she won't use she can't use magic anymore, and he has this kind of nice line where he's like, "Yeah, but you traded it for something that's worth even more than that, right? Everybody's future." And they have a nice moment together, and then we cut away to Di Maria, who basically the ironic irony that she had laughed about how Brandy was one of their prisoners, and now she's one of their prisoners. But it's weird, like. I guess that those are, like, the anti-magic cuffs. She has those on.
She's tied up bondage stuff.
Yeah, I don't know why they also thought, well, we're going to have to tie her to a chair, too. And we'll just do that tit tie that just makes the breast look bigger. Like, this seems really inefficient. I guess if they were like, well, we came and just let her hang around with just the shackles on, because maybe she could warrior fight her way out of them. But why tying her to a chair just by her tits? Seems like such an impractical way of going about things. Brandy says that she will basically parlay with August on behalf of Fairy Tail. There's no chance to do it with Irene. She's just too... They don't have a good relationship. But she says that she was kind of friendly with August, and she's known him since she was basically like a child. So maybe they could work things out. And Lucy's like, I trust her. Don't worry. She's going to go ahead and do this. Cut away up to the north. We see Irene. She's walking. She tells some story about how this mountain has a legend about a white heavenly maiden and a black heavenly maiden who fought against one another. I'm just going to go ahead and assume that the white heavenly maiden that this is bringing up is going to be Urza later on, since she's dressed all in black. And we get introduced to her two lieutenants, Juliet's son and Heine Lunacy.
Okay, Juliet's son, I get that. Heine or Heine Lunacy. You named a character Lunacy.
Yeah. Not like Lunacy, like L-U-N-A-C-Y either. Like Lunacy. Two separate words put together as one. Who are kind of just like her bickering lieutenants. And I guess Juliet's supposed to be pretty dumb as well, because she mentions
she's
like,
an airhead.
Yeah, they're like...
They're Betty and Veronica.
Yeah. Like one's all in white, the other's all in black. And they're like, you two remind me of the black and white maidens. And the one who's dressed all white's like, I call dibs on black! They're like... Fucking idiot. She just kind of continues telling the story about things. And we cut away to the Fairy Tail members who are up north. You may remember, this is a little bit ago that we actually saw this. It's sort of like Gajeel's group that went up north with like Elfman and his family. And they had met essentially Sabretooth's group and I think another guild, Mermaid Heel or something like that. Not Mermaid Heel, Blue Pegasus maybe, who had all been crucified. They had all been like crucified on sticks, and the evil army was like marching them through. So we cut to that and they're fighting against their army.
We rescued them all!
Yeah. They rescued everybody, apparently. Because they're like carrying them back and saying like, don't worry, you know, it's fine, just leave the fight to us. But then all of a sudden, all the snow melts away and there's just a beautiful field. And Irene says, we have new guests. Is everything prepared? Bradman? Larkade? Larsade? I don't care. Bradman's here, so I'm pretty stoked. And
looking pretty sweet in that panel he shows up in silhouette in, too.
Yeah. And we see Gajeel. I guess they see these three. And Gajeel says... Oh, no, sorry. Rogue says they have three savage monsters on their side. And Gajeel laughs and says, well, we've got the Savage Six right here! The title of this chapter, The Savage Six, is the Heroes Group, which is Gajeel, okay, Levy, eh.
Well, I like how Levy is like, wait, are you...
me too?
Are you including me in that? Yeah. Like, Lissana's over there!
Yeah, I'm like, at least she acknowledges, like, I don't think I should be part of this group. Mira Jane, perfectly acceptable. Elfman... he should be, but he's not normally presented that way, but fine, I'll go with it. Lily Panther, didn't even realize he was in the shot for like 5 minutes. I was like, who's the sixth person?
And then Lissana's like, and then Lissana's over there and she's like, I'm Nick Tiger Bikini!
Tiger Bikini!
Like, have you ever beaten anybody?
I don't want to be part of any group that considers me fucking Lissana one of its members. Like, if I was part of the Savage Six and it's like, yeah, it's five of us strong people and Lissana, I'd be like, this is fucking horseshit. There is no reason I should be put in the same team as fucking Lasada.
Can you imagine, like, you're in Spider-Man, and it's like, oh my god, Spider-Man's gonna fight a new iteration of the Sinister Six. Who's in it? It's like, Dr. Octopus, Scorpion, Shocker.
Venom.
Venom's in it.
Sandman.
Like, Sandman's there. Lasada. Well, Spider-Man's gonna kick their asses, clearly.
Yeah.
They resorted to getting Lasada.
Why didn't you just change the name to the Sinister Five at that point? I know you lose the alliteration, but is it really worth hanging this person on? Yeah,
we could be the Fearsome Five, like that one, that one Darkwing Duck cartoon.
No, like, or we could just cut out Scorpion and go with the Super Scary Four. He's like, what the? Come on!
Why are you getting rid of me? Well, I mean, you are kind of lame.
I mean, do you do anything besides have the tail? Like, no. You look at Certain Lane Vulture in, though, and he's just an old man with wings. Yeah.
But I become young when I suck away someone's youth.
Like, holy shit, Spider-Man's universe is weird. I don't like any of this once I look into it further. Kraven the Hunter's immortal unless killed by Spider-Man. What is this? So that's Fairy Tale this week. It's not a bad chapter.
Wait a minute, Morbius is here? Why is he here?
The Drawer Blade villain. I bounce around. Yeah, it's a fun chapter. But
you know, there's one What If comic where sharks eat me. Marvel What If comics are amazing. Okay.
Food Wars.
Food Wars time. Chapter 165, Two Faces. Starring Aaron Eckhart. Okay, so. Last time, Soma completed his dish, which would challenge Tsukasa, and he presents it. And it's at this moment, finally, that Soma realizes, we never decided how to judge this. Tsukasa's like, well, I guess we'll just have to be our own judges. Soma then goes to the door, he's like, hey girls, you want to come in and judge this?
It's like, so he's just known this whole time?
And Tsukasa's like, what? Oh, they've been here this whole time? And Soma's like, oh, you guys were trying to hide? I love Hisaka's like, well, it's because, why were we hiding?
I love her, and it's like, I don't know!
Oh, God. But Hisako points out, it's like, you know, you're putting this decision on our shoulders that, you know, we could force you to join Central. But someone's like, yeah, but I can't afford to back down. So, yeah. Makes sense to me that he would be like that. And Arena says, yes, if you insist, you know, I'll test your dishes. And so they all try Soma's dish first. And Tsukasa also bites into it. And Hisako has this... I actually like the visualization of this bit, because not only are her clothes being ripped off, but you see the chestnuts cracking open around her, too. And even Tsukasa is quite impressed as he eats it. Like, he gets... It's like his shirt comes undone.
Yeah,
he doesn't get fully naked, but he's like, oh yeah, this is really good. You know, the sweet chestnuts makes it melt in my mouth. And, oh, it's good. And he explains some of his chestnut sauce and so on and so forth. And they explain that his special ingredient for this is coffee, which only Arianna is able to specifically distinguish. Basically, it balances out the chestnuts. Like, I never understand these full explanations of the balance of flavors and textures and all that shit.
Because they don't equate it in Pop-Tart terms.
I can't equate it in vanilla Coke or chicken pot pie or strawberry cheesecake ice cream terms. So there you go. And even Arian is impressed. The chestnut is shelled while she gets stripped. Think visualization for her.
What's interesting, because Arina did have a thing where she didn't want to eat most of his food, but she has time a few times, but she's never completely disrobed.
Right.
So even here, she doesn't completely, her clothes are starting to, this is a metric in her series for her character progression with the
even if you just look at the different characters in this scene, because Hisako's like, ah! And Sekai's like, oh, that's pretty good. You know, his shirt comes undone. He doesn't, like, actually take off any of his clothes, though it doesn't look like he's wearing any underwear. And Arina reacts more strongly than Tsukasa, but not as strongly as Hisako. like her clothes get torn, but they all stay on, kind of thing. I wonder if it was intentional or not.
It's just
fan service because Jesus Christ, Aaron is freaking showing areolas in that picture, I swear.
I feel it is intentional. I feel that this is legitimately a barometer for the amount of impression that leaves on people in this series is how much of their clothes get torn off.
But Aaron actually goes full, like, Simpson on Soma's food. She's like, well, for a dish that you made, Yukihira, I guess it has enough of the correct elements to be considered a proper French dish. And he goes like, oh, that's actually really high praise from her.
Yeah, because she has always, anytime she's tried his food, like, even though she's always liked it, she's always still like, this sucks. You suck. Get away.
I totally didn't like it.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really cool response from Tsukasa, because he's just kind of like, the dish is just like making him think, and he's pondering it, and everyone kind of looks at him expectantly, and he's just like, all right, I need to get my dish ready.
Whoops.
So he presents two faces of roast venison, and rather than having her clothes torn off, Hisako's reaction is like she imagines herself in this dress in a forest as the deer is approaching her, and she's like, oh, it's pure tranquil harmony. Tsukasa explains that one of the two faces he made with sauce pulvrade, I guess, and they were with pulvrade, I don't know French.
He made one sauce that's super fucking sweet and one that's, like, really brings out the meaty flavor. It's like a four-page explanation.
It's very, very long. And Soma is like, this is incredible, it's great. We don't get, like, a close tearing-off scene from him, though.
So, no.
So Hisako and Erina both have a decision to make. And Hisako's thinking, like, oh, you know, this is not a simple choice. You know, they're not something that can be compared so easily. They're entirely different beasts. But they each come to their decision, and the chapter ends with both of them reaching for a plate. We don't see if they've reached for the same one, or have reached for different ones, or which one they've reached to. But Erina basically is thinking to herself, the one that brought out the best of the venison more expertly is clearly... And it cuts off.
I wonder if the way they might play this off, this is just a prediction theory I'm going off here, because they don't mention it on this chapter, but they should both significantly want Soma to win, because he would become the new first seat, and he doesn't have to work for Central. So, my thought is, next week, Hisako pushes forward Soma's dish, because she's like, it was really good, plus... this is the situation I want to have happen.
Right.
But Erina pushes forward Tsukasa's, so
because
it's like...
it's the one that's legitimately,
better. And they're like, it's a tie. Neither of these have to go into effect now. But the fact that Erina pushed it forward kind of shows significantly, like, his was the better dish, objectively.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And, I mean, there's a couple of different ways that they could go about this. Tsukasa had an interesting reaction to Soma's dish, so maybe they'll choose Tsukasa's dish and he'll be like, I'm not going to hold you to it because you impressed me with this. I mean, obviously, this isn't going to result in Tsukasa losing his seat and Soma becoming the first seat, regardless of what happens, but I am actually kind of impressed with enough has been set up where it's like, okay, there's a couple different directions you can go with this. The easiest thing to do would be to just have them each choose a different dish, and so there's a tie, and the whole thing is called off. But there's enough groundwork laid where you could think it might go in a couple of different directions aside from just that. That's the easy cop-out, and it could very well happen, and seems like the most likely thing. But I'm not being like, oh, clearly they're going to both choose different dishes so that nothing happens. There's a couple of different things that could happen.
Yeah. So. I dig it. Good chapter. It's fun.
Let's move on to Shit Getting Fucked Up. My Hero Academia. Chapter 189.
All for a certain one.
Last time, All For One showed up.
This first panel's fucked up. Like,
oh, with Toga getting gooped away.
I didn't know what was happening at first. It looked like it, because she's the only person that it looks like it, like, catches her in her mouth. So it looked like she was vomiting out something at first. Like, it looks like something, she's like, this is unpleasant. I was like, oh my god, is he killing the rest of them? I was like, oh no, he's just transporting them away. He just chose what looks like the most uncomfortable way of doing it for her.
And they, all of the villains immediately get taken away in this big split page, the last of which is All Might trying to grab Bakugo, I think. Bakugo already got transported away. He's trying to grab Shigaraki.
Yeah.
They explain that Kuragiri's portal, you know, it actually opens like a portal that you can, you know, reach through. Whereas this one, they basically, like, dematerialize. There's no way to actually stop it, even if they're holding on to people, like Kamui Woods is. So a few Nomu come in, and All Might's super pissed off. He immediately whirls his body and throws them all away, and goes outside. He calls out to Endeavor, and he's like, hey, can you handle this situation? And Endeavor's like, what do you, does it look like I can? He's got all these Nomu already strewn around him. And All Might's like, alright, then take care of everyone here. I'm gonna go. Yeah. And, so we, catch up to where All For One has just beaten the crap out of Best Genist and Company. And, he's giving him the slow clap. Saying, you know, I was actually just planning on blasting all of you straight to hell, but you grabbed them by their clothes and threw them aside in the nick of time. Such quick decision-making, such technique, such incredible reflexes. Best Genist is clearly intimidated by the guy, but he's like, all right, well, I mean, I've got to take this guy out. You know, a first-class hero would never use this as an excuse that he's so strong. That's just an excuse for failure, but he's suddenly blasted in the chest by some sort of invisible force. And All For One says, your strength is the product of endless training and a wealth of experience, but I don't need it, because your quirk isn't one that would suit Tamura. And we get our first really good look at him. I know we've been using the Bane voice for Toga, but holy shit. This is a freaking proper Bane mask.
Do we give him the Bane voice as well, then?
I think that he deserves a more dignified voice if we are going to give him one. Because, Jesus Christ, this guy is so badass and creepy and cool-looking. And he's got this...
You're saying there's something undignified about the Bane voice?
What do you mean I'm not dignified?
I'm very dignified, duckies.
Oh, it would be very painful. You see what I did there?
You little finger. I'm not little finger in this. Carcetti, then. I'm not Carcetti. I'm not any other character you think I'm just the guy. I'm a senator or something.
Oh, Senator Littlefinger.
Oh, what a lovely singing voice you have.
I mean, like, I wouldn't mind if we gave him, like, you know, that full voiceover. Doesn't sound like a character in the film. Sounds like someone talking over the film effects. But he shouldn't sound like whatever the fuck Tom Hardy was doing in that movie.
My brother keeps mentioning it now, and I can't stop thinking about it, the fact that Tom Hardy is, like, 5'8" or something like that.
He is of average height.
So it's like a 5'8" Bane that had to, like, stand on stairs in scenes of people to not look shorter than they are.
Right. I mean, you're not quite as undignified as them being like, okay, Robert Downey Jr., we need you to wear these high-heeled shoes so that you look tall enough as Tony Stark when you're doing scenes with tall-ass Gwyneth Paltrow. But, But notably, All For One says that he's, you know, not going to take Best Genist quirk, not so that, because he has no interest in using it, but because it wouldn't suit Tamura, which is interesting.
We've seen that this guy has the ability to take quirks, and that seems to be what the term All For One would imply. Now, the thought at that point was maybe he's kind of gathering them for himself, but this clearly shows that the person he has in mind to pass all these on to seems to be Shigaraki.
Which is interesting. And we know that One for All was created by All for One. He has the ability to bestow quirks that way. So it's interesting that we've got this dynamic now. It's not just that Shigaraki is his follower, disciple, whatever. He is, this is basically, if I'm getting the implication right, a full dark reflection of All Might and Deku.
Mm-hmm.
Shigaraki is to All for One as Deku is to All Might, their followers. And so this not only does a lot to make the villain relationship more interesting, but it also helps to position Shigaraki as a more proper villain, a more proper rival for Deku.
It does. It's building up an intense thing, and they're making All for One terrifying, like, immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Because every...
He acts terrifying. He looks amazing.
All of the other students who are still hidden are so terrified of him that none of them can move, and most of them are about to throw up. Like, you mentioned it last time. I thought maybe it was just a weird face. But no, him and Yayurozo are literally holding in vomit right now. Mm. Or at least their breath. Maybe not vomit, but...
Even Todoroki is like, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
And all of them are just thinking that they can't move. And yeah, Yairozu and Deku are gonna throw up because they're so scared. And then Bakugo shows up because he's been teleported in. And All for One is like, oh, I'm sorry about that. And then all the other villains show up and All for One says, you failed again, Zamora. But you mustn't lose heart. There will be more chances to set things right. That's why I've brought along your little band. And the boy, because you determined that he was an important pawn. So go and try again. That's what I'm here to help you to do. It's all for you.
That's so creepy and terrifying.
And he's like, you know, because Shigaraki is like, you know, disappointed. He's on his knees before him, and All for One is like extending a helping hand sort of for him. And so this gives, you know, additional context to the relationship between Shigaraki and All for One that we saw in the flashback last time when All for One appeared offering to help him. And it's interesting because it's like he's it's like he wants Shigaraki to stand on his own feet, and that makes sense if he wants him to follow in his footsteps. But of course, he's perfectly willing to step in if he's needed. Mm-hmm. It makes him a more interesting character than if he were just manipulating everyone. The fact that it's like he could be causing so much more damage with all this power that he has, but he wants Shigaraki to do it instead.
Yeah, it symbolizes a lot of power that he's so insanely powerful and so just absurd at what he can do, but he's so patient with Tagora, which seems like something a character like this shouldn't be at all. Like, usually your villains are like, you failed me for the last time! This is a guy who's like, don't lose heart. I brought all your friends. You can try again, because remember, it's all for you. Like, something
all for a certain one. Yeah.
It's very unnerving.
And there's this great moment that happens in the next two pages, because basically what happens next in that sequence is All Might flies in and immediately attacks All for One. All for One blocks his attack, and he's like, oh, here to kill me again, All Might. And so it's like, oh, we're going to have our big ultra-hero versus ultra-villain throwdown, and this Bakugo is there to witness it.
Mm.
So some important seems like it's going to happen here. But in between that time, we cut back to focus on Deku's group. And the first thing that happens is Deku thinks to himself, I'm completely frozen out of fear, but Bakugo's right there. My body wouldn't move back then, and that's why I couldn't save you. My body is healthy now. I've got to do something. I've got to act now so I can save Kachan. And just as he's getting that determination, Ida looks over, realizes what's happening, reaches across and grabs onto Deku's jacket and just looks at him. And he's thinking to himself, I will protect you.
He stops him from basically getting killed.
Right. And it's all just in a look that he gives him.
It's a very cool look.
Yeah, and it all comes together, you know, all the discussion that they had, and, you know, this, he does, you know, stay true to what he promised him. He's like, I'm going to keep you guys out of trouble. And that's what he's doing. And so all this stuff, that it's weird, because like, it's such a small thing that all of that character development and build-up over the last few things that we've seen Neji do all came into this one little gesture. But, I mean, it's a great way for Deku to witness what happened without him, you know, looking like a chump or a coward or something like that. It was, you know, someone talked some sense into him and was like, don't go get yourself killed. So really, really like this chapter.
Very good.
Very cool.
We might need to pick up the pace, though, for these last three.
Yeah, it's 9 o'clock already, so let's move on. Nisekoi, a lot of stuff happened. A lot of stuff happened in Nisekoi. A lot of revelations were made. Raku's mother is in a lot of it, and the series insisted on not showing her face.
Yeah.
Raku's mother wrote the story that Raku and Onodera and Shitake found out about. They all met each other in childhood because their mothers knew each other in high school. And Shitake is going to go and meet someone. She's going to go to the location, I guess, that they first met at. Okay. One Piece. I've completely forgotten what happened to One Piece. Luffy nearly dies.
Basically, it's sort of our starting introduction into the world. We see, what's his name? Not Germa. I forget what this guy's name is. Vito. Vito is kind of introducing us. He explains like how back in the day he essentially read what's essentially like Cyborg 009, I think. The equivalent of that. I think the antagonist, that's what Germa 66 is based off of. And he talks like, oh yeah, I like that book, but I really actually just like the villains. Villains are awesome. Germa's great. They're super awesome. And we just kind of meet more of the people in here. Caesar Clowns in a Cage. We meet Goaty, who's another one of Capone's guys. And then we see Lola. Like, for a brief moment, she mentions, like, you can't beat up Sanji, because you'll piss him. You know, he's the fucking groom. Don't do that. Sanji, for a moment, doesn't even recognize her. He's like, I swear, I've seen something real familiar about her before. Mm-hmm. I just want to know. I said this was going to happen a while ago, and everyone's like, you're wrong, that hasn't been revealed yet. I was like, I'm pretty sure Lola said her mom was one of the emperors.
We cut to Luffy's group. Everyone is like, oh, God, I need more food. And Luffy is begging for Sanji, food, and ice cream. They catch a giant fish, and they're like, yay, food! Is this edible, though? And Chopper is like, oh, let me go look out to make sure it's safe to eat. Okay, let's see here. All right. Oh, God, Sanji's bookshelf is full of naked people. Okay, guys, you just gotta make sure not to eat the fish's skin, because there's poison on it. Sanji's got this very specific note, and Luffy's like, the skin is delicious!
It's like a fucking Simpsons moment, where it's just like, the only thing poisonous on it is the skin. Well, I've eaten all the skin! Like, God, damn it! Damn it!
And then later on, everyone's cooked it up, and it's like, oh, Nami, you did a great job. And I was like, yeah, I managed to make sure to follow Sanji's recipe exactly. And meanwhile, Luffy's on the floor, foaming at the mouth. Ah! And Chopper's like, oh, he's gonna die, and I don't have enough medicine to save him.
Oh,
Young! Oh, Nami, we gotta buy an answer. Oh, so Nami, we gotta save him. Oh, so good! Oh, God. Yeah, they reach Germa 66, basically, they reach the ship that belongs to Germa 66.
They think it's going to be one of Big Mom's ships, and Peckham's is like, don't worry, I'll talk to them. But then we see, like, there are transponder snails beneath it that are surveillance, and a Germa 66 ship shows up instead with somebody who looks a lot like Sanji on it.
Right. It might be his father, it might be some other relative, but either way, he's got the very distinct
curly brow.
Curly eyebrow. And then we learned that One Piece is going to be off next week.
So I'm like, what a bummer. The week after Golden Week?
Yeah. If he's like, need to have more sex with my wife. Shut up.
It was a fine chapter.
All right, just all right chapter.
Just
some,
nothing.
Some fun moments in it, but yeah, a lot of setup. Toriko. A frog ate the moon.
This feels like it's a huge chapter, Toriko.
It really does.
We meet God, which is essentially what we've been presented with as being the end kind of goal ingredient. Like, this is the thing. And it does seem cool. Like, I like the fact that every one of its cells are essentially look like planets,
mm-hmm.
and that makes up its back. It's just, I don't know why. I guess when you have the idea built up that this was the top ingredient, essentially from the start of the series, it's just hard to live up to what you would anticipate things to be. It's just a frog.
Especially because it's played as pseudo-humorous, the way that Chimabukuro does a lot of stuff in the series. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, it's kind of a parody. So, you know, this giant frog thing appears in front of Toriko's group. It lashes out at them with its tongue. And so he's like, I gotta deflect it! He deflects it, and its tongue flies up into the sky, sticks to the moon, and the frog is like, okay, it eats the moon. And it just comes back down and launches its tongue again. And it's like, oh no, Gakumatsu! And Zebra's like, it's okay, I put sound armor around him so he's safe. But now we gotta eat it so that we can save Komatsu. It's like, God damn it, Komatsu, again! What the fuck, man?
I don't know why. I get. Yeah. And its capture level's 10,000, which I think's supposed to be a big deal, but I've lost all sense of scale for capture levels at this point, so I really don't even know what that means in comparison.
It is weird to think that the four beasts were, like, you know, capture level, like, 500 when combined together or something like that.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago. Okay. Let's finish off with World Trigger.
World Trigger, I think we could spend some time on. Let's let that breathe. So this
it's a very backstory chapter.
Yeah.
So. Chapter 142, Kuniharu Kakizaki. Amazingly, this chapter is about Kuniharu Kakizaki. So we actually start off a little bit with Katori, her and Rakuro. They're like, God damn it, what are we gonna do? And Rakuro's like, stop trying to fucking just charge in, you idiots, because their team has been, and their team is also trying to call them off. They're like, don't get tripped up, and so on and so forth. And then we cut over to Yuma, who is basically closer to winning, of course, since he's only got two members of Kakizaki squad left. And of course, what's her name? They mentioned her name several times this chapter. I'm just forgetting it at this moment. The female squad member on Kakizaki's team.
Teria? I don't know how to pronounce it. I see T-E-R-U-Y-A.
Fumika.
Well, whatever. This is her other name.
Fumika had in the last chapter proposed that she go off on her own to try and take out Chika while Kakizaki holds Yuma at bay. And Kakizaki's agreed to that. He engages with Yuma while Teruya goes off after Chika. And, of course, they give Chika warning, and she's trying to figure out what her route's going to be, because she's like, I don't have time to actually sneak around behind her with the bagworm. I've got to take the shortest route possible while I avoid her lead bullets, because I can't shield myself against them. The announcers express surprise over this tactic, because, what's his name? Guy from the dull-eyed guy, whatever.
Takeda?
Yes. Takeda. He says, like, you know, I'm surprised that Kakizaki did this, because Kakizaki's main weakness is that he always tries to take on all the responsibility of the squad. He never sends his teammates on high risks by themselves. He always tries to get everyone together and is very cautious. That's always been his strategy. It's sound and solid. But he's very different this time. And they're like, yeah, but might be a little bit too late in the fight in order to do this. And get a flashback from Kakizaki, which goes across this chapter. It starts off with he and Arashiyama joining Border when they're both 15 years old. They've, like, just joined up, and they're at this PR event 4 years ago. And, you know, they're taking questions from the reporters and stuff. One of them says, okay, if there were another massive neighbor invasion, what would you do? Would you prioritize protecting your families, or would you protect the people? And Kakizaki's like,
duh.
I don't know how to do this. And Arashiyama's like, I would protect my family. That's the reason I joined Border. And the reporters are like, so you're saying that you would neglect the city in order to, you know, protect your own selfish interests, because there are people who lost their families in the last invasion. Don't you think that you're coming across a bit insensitive? And Kaki's like, oh my god, you know, it's those reporters who hate Border. And Arashiyama is just, you know, shrugging off. He's like, well, once I confirm my family was okay, yeah, I would return to the battlefield and fight. And for those who lost their families and those who didn't, along with the families of all of you here, I will protect them as best I can. And as long as my family's safe, I've got nothing to worry about, so I believe I can give my best until the last moment. That's why I prioritize them. You know, he just handles it so easily.
I think it's kind of fucked up, though, that Borderlands, like, because it's only been open 1 year, so these kids are, I know they're B-ranks at this point, but they're still basically, like, newbies to the organization. They're like, yeah, just throw them out there unscripted against the media. That seems so fucked up.
But basically, Arashiyama, like, handles it so well that it turns into a great PR moment for Border. And, you know, one of the guys who's there is like, yeah, you know, Border is always looking for new recruits and staff members, you know. If you want to help us out, help out this cool guy, you know.
And Kakizaki kind of was like, I was worthless in that entire exchange. I asked to be taken off the PR squad because I'm just not meant for that. He just has no confidence in himself. And... Mm-hmm. Leaves the group, then meets a new operator.
Right. And Arashiyama is kind of was like, helped set him up. He's like, oh, you know, here's this young, you know, newer operator. Here are these two new recruits. They will join your new squad, since I figure, you know, if you're going to leave us, you're going to need your own squad, obviously. And Kakizaki is thinking, like, okay, you know, I've got Fumika, who is this genius who was one of the nominees for best rookie. I've got Kotaro, who is the only agent at Border who was still in elementary school when he first joined up. And he's like, you know, why do I have these freaking prodigies on my squad? And they say, like, well, we actually saw you on TV a couple years ago. And when we saw you up there, we thought, oh, this guy is worth supporting. And, you know, they actually thought he was cool. And basically, this all comes down to Kakizaki's like, these two are freaking amazing. And their true abilities are way better than their current ratings at Border. I'm to blame for them being at their current level. I am holding them back. And he's got such a little confidence in himself that he's like, I know that it's my fault that they're not doing better. And the fact that such great agents are wandering at this rank is because of me. I'm their captain. I can't bring out their true strength. And for you guys, we may be just another stepping stone. My bad, Kakizaki, I'll take 3 points. You don't even think you're going to lose. But just because these new guys will surpass us, it shouldn't diminish my squadmate's true value. And Yuma moves in to cut him down, and he manages to avoid one stab and grabs onto Yuma's arm. And Yuma immediately cuts him down with his other arm. He's like, I know you're strong, but sorry. I'm not going to hand over victory to you. And while he's got Yuma pulled in close, before he's forced to bail out, he just unloads on him with his gun. And that's where the chapter ends. So it seems at this moment as if it was a simultaneous takedown, which could really hurt Tamakoma if that's what happened.
It's a really interesting chapter, because Kakizaki squad going into this was the boring squad. Like, they didn't have a lot to them. There wasn't a whole lot given about them, and like,
because they all got along stuff.
Yeah, they were like the other group. You can immediately see the story within it, when it's like, oh, she's super talented, but she's a bitch and her teammates want her to get better, but she thinks they're weighing her down. You can see that immediately. With this, it's just like three people, they get along, the leader's just kind of not getting great places. But the chapter does a good job of really characterizing Kakizaki. It's somewhat interesting in a way, because by the end of this chapter, you're going to have some kind of mild affection, at least, for Kakizaki. You're going to be like, I like this guy. He seems noble. And if you look at it in that way, you're like, in this moment, the character I kind of almost want to root for a little bit is fighting who should be one of the protagonists of the series, and Yuma almost takes on this role of almost like an Aegon, like the absurdly powerful like character who our hero just can't overcome. Like, normally your hero is a little bit of an underdog, but here Yuma's clearly better than him, so it's almost like seeing him as the stronger figure in things. It's kind of an interesting way.
And also, they're looking past Kaki's hockey squad at this point.
I don't know if I'd say that completely. I had to go back and reread to see if Yuma... I guess he must have said that line at one point. Sorry, my bad, I'll take 3 points. But I feel like they wouldn't completely blow past anybody. Maybe Yuma would, but I don't think Yuma's taken out here. I think he's going to be heavily wounded, but I don't think he's going to be gone. It seems really weird if this match that's supposed to be Tamakoma 2's, like, revival is Yuma got the shit kicked out of him because he got too cocky and didn't think this guy would be better than he was.
And then you're left with the two guys who can't score points.
Yeah, I think that would, if that is the case, that does bode well for Osamu having a pretty awesome moment, but I think Yuma will still make it out of this one. But I really like this chapter. I thought it was great. Mm.
Yeah. All right, and that's going to do it. So let's go over our favorite chapters and MVPs for the week. My favorite chapter was World Trigger this week. It was a close call between that and a couple others, but I did really like this whole chapter, this whole look into Kagezaki's backstory and the way that it's affecting the matchup right now. So that's going to do it for me.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought World Trigger was the best chapter this week. I thought it was a great look into another group, and I like seeing the world of World Trigger continue to develop.
And our audience chose My Hero Academia, which I totally get that. That would have been on my short list. Easy. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't my favorite. Though I am going to say my weekly MVP, I'm going to give it to Ida. It had a very small moment, but one that I thought really, really stood out.
Absolutely. He was the one I'd go with. I went with Kakizaki Squad. Solely for the fact that it was a character I thought I wouldn't give the slightest fuck about when we met him and we're going into this match. But Ida, I think, had a great moment as well. It's very small, you said, but it completely... He did what he came there to do, and he was, no matter what, not going to let Deku kill himself or get killed.
So you're going for Kakizaki?
Yeah, I'm going with Kakizaki, though, just on the fact that I really didn't think anything of that character going into it, and I think he absolutely earned my pick just from how much he got this chapter.
Okay.
And even if he doesn't get Yuma, that was still a cool ending.
Mm. It's good... You know, standalone alternate perspective chapter.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, so let's wrap things up then.
Let's do it.
Kind of forgotten almost how to do this. Thank everyone for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap, which we record here on hitbox.tv/RoloT, normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change things up as schedules allow, basically. So to stay updated on all the changes in our live recording schedule, you can follow us on Twitter. He is at RoloT and I am at YRuler of Time. And of course, also be sure to follow...
You can't see me right now because my fucking camera very keeps blurry. Fucking up.
You can also follow WMR Podcast for podcast-specific stuff. Chris also tends to put up his thoughts on stuff that we're reading on that account as well. Mm-hmm. And you can check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. You can check them out on our YouTube, Weekly Manga Recap. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes and help us get up past a few of those hobby ones that we used to be ranked among the elites of. But
one time.
Oh, the glory days.
Nick, are we the Mike Posner podcast?
Also, be sure to send criticism, questions, and suggest manga for us to read. Send all that stuff to our email, which is weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. I figured we would go ahead and start on this since I kind of blew the surprise a few months ago and we still haven't gotten to it. Our next suggestion we're going to look at is a Pokemon Adventure, also known as Pokemon Special.
Ooh.
It is one of my favorite interpretations of Pokemon ever, and I can't wait to see what Chris thinks of it.
Is this the particular part I should look for?
We're going to read the red and blue part.
Okay.
All right, then. See how things go from there.
Kishmiggity.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters because your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We're a little late with the April bonus podcast.
That one's coming very soon, guys. Yeah. It's
a lot of stuff came up.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But I think it's really good. There's a lot of great stuff in it, and it should be up within, like, the next couple days. We're going to be getting everything out at a faster rate, but yeah, there was about a 2-week span there where we were both had
all of a sudden it was just like, I got no time to do this. real life intervenes sometimes. Sorry. Yeah.
But we'll make sure if there's anybody out there who was a patron in April and isn't in May, so they can't just grab it when it comes out, just let me know. Send an email over to Weekly Manga Recap, and I'll make sure you get a copy of that. We're not trying to screw anybody over or anything like that. We want to make sure everybody gets it.
Especially if you were looking specifically forward to that sweet comedy manga, or comedy month ending.
There's some good shit in there. By the way, got to give special thanks to our newest patrons, Rivel Roth, Holy, Jelly Olsen, Feral the Gecko, and Anarchist Hamster. Thank you, all of you. I don't know why I'm doing thumbs up. I've had my cover on for half this episode because my Skype keeps fucking up.
It is really weird to look over in Skype and be like, Jesus Christ, Chris is so fucking pixely right now.
I don't know why it is. It just keeps, like, it's fine on my end, but it keeps telling me, like, your internet connection sucks, which bumps up where my camera is on the screen, which fucks up the capture I have going on. I'm like, I can't deal with this shit anymore.
Special thanks also go out to Steve Mann, our tag artist, who has drawn some awesome stuff for us. He's on Patreon with the under Steve Mann. He's New Rock Fanboy on DeviantArt, and he's got, I think, a few different Tumblr accounts. So check out his work. He does some awesome stuff.
He did a great, he's doing a whole theme for the JoJo stuff as well. Kind of doing them in the same art style, so I'm sure if I mentioned you, he'll be doing the Pokemon stuff in the same style as well.
Cool. And lastly, thank you to our good friend Infamous Planet, who has done much to help us out, like making this framework thing, which we may hound him to update in a few months or something like that. Infamous, I haven't called you the in a long time. Can you do another one, please? I don't know how to Photoshop.
You need help.
It's
like a Leap Beat agent. It's like you just hang out the window like, help! And then Infamous Planet shows up and he's like, you were a scanner boy, I said see you later boy, and you do a bunch of claps, and at the end of it you have a new fucking stream overlay, and you're like, yeah, agents!
I'll give you a child to abuse.
This is like the longest, most obscure Leap Beat agents reference ever. 90% of the audience, like, what the fuck are they talking about? Why do you start seeing Avril Lavigne?
Oh god, the only thing about Elite Beat Agents is I know is the Get Wake Up and Do It, is that so? Oh god. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening / watching, and we'll see you next time.
Yes. Oh wait, I guess we need a joke.
What, Elite Beat Agents isn't a joke? No, we need more! We didn't talk about Disney's Descendants long enough at the start of the episode.
Nobody knows which starter we liked from each generation best!